Okay, members in absence of our chair, we are going to start. We do have some testimony regarding House File 1131. Representative Moe, this is your bill, correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And so I know that we can't do anything formal and official, but we certainly can hear about your bill until we get enough people for a quorum, and we'll move it at that time. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Fire away.
Members of the committee, this is a review for this committee. We passed this bill out of this committee, and I think unanimously. It was a very successful, it would be a very successful program that we all recognize that. We sent it to the House floor, and after a veto, it was taken out of the bill. This House File 1131, a capacity building grant, essentially what this does is allows for regions of the state who don't have the administrative help to apply for the existing funding, the Minnesota MHFA and other sources, federal sources, for housing. It would provide them with the assistance they need to actually coordinate their housing efforts. Many of us don't have in greater Minnesota, or even in more impoverished regions of the metro area, don't have the resources to actually leverage the funds that are available. I mean, it takes, as we know, regrettably, it takes much administrative effort to actually pull grants in to build housing projects, whether it's supportive housing, emergency housing, or long-term housing. And so this bill would provide the resources that many of our regions of the state don't have. I think we'll probably support it again once we actually can move it and Chair Clark gets here. But for now, I'd like to again introduce, for those of you who haven't seen him in the last few hours, Michael Dahl, Executive Director of Coalition for the Homeless, to provide us more information. Mr. Dahl.
Okay, so who are we moving to? Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Liz Quapple. I work as Associate Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and in my spare time also serve as City Councilor for Eveleth up on the Iron Range. And Michael, we didn't get there from him enough recently, so put me here. So for folks who may have forgotten since we took this up last year, the continuum of care process was basically, in 1987, Congress gave HUD some money to finally deal with homelessness in this country, and HUD figured out pretty quickly that they didn't want to read a bajillion applications from all these little shelter programs across the country. And so they said, how about if you folks, you shelter providers, get together in regions and you figure out who we should fund. You rate the applications, and we'll give you bonus points when you come together if you bring in other folks from the community. Church folks and school folks and corrections folks, bring in a broad base of community folks to help you rank which applications should be funded and what your priorities should be for dealing with homelessness in your community. And so our continuum of care regions in Minnesota are really huge. Southeast is 20 counties. Northeast is the entire Arrowhead outside of St. Louis. And there's Northeast, Southeast, West Central, Central, Southeast, and Southwest. So one of the challenges we have in rural areas is that rural areas start out with less resources and are given less resources as a result. Limited programs means limited resources for people who are homeless or in poverty. Limited programs means limited staff and volunteers to do outreach. Limited outreach means that less people are counted as homeless. Less people counted means the area is considered to have less need. Less need means less money. Less money means less leverage, which means even less money. Even less money means even less services. And even less services means that the area is considered to have less capacity. And so what happens is that sometimes people are not served, or organizations from the Twin Cities metro area are brought in to supposedly improve capacity, but basically end up improving their own capacity down here, not in our rural areas that need it so badly. And I realize that you're facing a budget crunch, and this might not be the time to come and ask for money, except that I think it's maybe the reason we especially need this money now. I think when a state is facing a budget shortfall, we need to make sure that we're really getting as many federal resources as possible, and the better coordination we can do in greater Minnesota, the the more federal resources we can bring in. We can also, by having better coordination in greater Minnesota, we can make sure that our state resources are used as efficiently and effectively as possible. The continuum of care coordinators provide technical assistance. They get together and talk about best practices and really figure out how to get the most bang for your buck with the programs in greater Minnesota. Also, they've been working now for the past couple years on developing plans to end homelessness across greater Minnesota, and really that's kind of first for rural planning in the country. And also with Wilder Research, we have in the past year been working with the Northern Minnesota Reservation communities, and for the first time in the country as well, have some good data on what homelessness looks like on the reservations. And so I think by having good continuum of care coordination, we'll be able to leverage some federal or some national philanthropic dollars as well, since we don't have many philanthropic resources otherwise available in greater Minnesota. I just wanted to address, too, right away that there has been some talk in recent years about eliminating the continuum of care process and just doing a balance of state. One of the things these continuum of care coordinators do, and I see it as a much smaller part of their role, is to write the grant to HUD. The much bigger part of their role is coordinating everything. When some good folks in a church in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, want to do something about homelessness, they call the continuum of care coordinator, and that person helps them figure out how to get started. And so that's really the big part of their job. A smaller part is writing the HUD grant. And so there's been some talk about if we combine all of greater Minnesota into just one application, we could have just one state staff person write the grant, submit it, and that would take care of all of our problems, and we wouldn't need these coordinators. And I just don't think that would work. I think the reason for that is that we get bonus dollars in each of our regions, and because our regions are small, for all of these reasons I just listed, few services means we can't find people, means we can't get money. So the Northeast Continuum, for example, gets a bonus of $25,000, which isn't a whole lot, but we believe that we can provide two units in Cooperstown County, and that's good. I think folks looking at this balance of state approach say, hey, if you combine this $25,000 with that $40,000 and this $70,000, we could really do a big project in Duluth or Rochester or St. Cloud. And for those of us who live in rural Minnesota, that's not good enough. You know, we know statewide that most people who are homeless for 6 months or less. So we don't want to send someone that might be homeless, might be fleeing a domestic violence situation in Cochise County, to take her kids, go down to St. Cloud, where it might have been more efficient because you could get economies of scale to do a big project. Take her women and children to go down to St. Cloud while she's trying to stabilize. It just doesn't make any sense. And so we'd really appreciate being able to serve folks locally where they're at. We know that's what does them the most good, and so we'd really appreciate your support for funding continuum of care coordination. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm not sure if I caught it, but can I get your last name again, please?
Quapala.
Thank you, Ms. Quapala. Representative Moll?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to just take a moment to thank all the high school students who've come in here to listen to issues about homelessness. This is extremely important to all of Minnesota, and you'd be surprised how big of an issue this is in your community, in suburban Minnesota as well. So thanks for choosing our committee to learn about today. I guess with that, I'd open up to questions, if anybody has any, from the committee. You've had a chance to hear this bill previously, and I think you're all on board, but
any questions from members? Well,
we've all been here
today. I think we can move the bill now. We have enough people here today. So if I understood what you were saying in the beginning, Representative Moe, your motion would be to pass this and send it to the register, General Register?
No, Mr. Chairman, we need to lay this over for inclusion in a finance bill.
Thank you. So Representative Moe moves that this be laid over for possible inclusion into our omnibus bill. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And unfortunately, Chair Clark is not here, but Representative Moe, do you know I'm anticipating that we're going to get a negative target from Chair Solberg and Chair Carlson. What do you know what the anticipation is? What programs will we cut if we add something like this?
Representative Moe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McNamara, I think we all recognize that our budget is difficult, and in particular will be for this committee. I think realistically, if we can get any resources at all into this program to allow greater Minnesota areas to leverage the money that's still available, it would be helpful for those areas. But if we get a negative target, I think, as you suggest, getting additional resources for this program will be difficult. However, I think it's important for all of us in this committee to recognize and to advocate to our leadership and to the governor, for those of you who have his ear, that in difficult financial times, those that are in most need of help are those without homes now or in danger of losing their homes. And so we should be arguing for our committee's target to actually be in the positive. And I think, Representative McNamara, you have ears that I don't have, and I know that you're on this committee and care deeply about these issues too, and if you could help us in advocating for the homeless, I'm sure they will all appreciate it, as would I.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moe, I guess the one concern I have is for the advocates and for the folks that are coming here to testify, I'm concerned that we don't create false expectations for them. I agree with you that their issues are important and very moving, but my concern is we bring more and more of these folks in that express the need for additional money. The reality is I'm worried that we're going to create false expectations, and I just want to be very careful as we go forward when we lay things over for possible inclusion, and the reality is, unfortunately, there's programs we're probably going to have to cut to make this work. I think everyone's in agreement, but that's potentially is the issue. I'm just concerned as we move forward that we're fair to people that are coming before us.
Mr. Dahl?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Senator Gerlach used to sit on this committee. As Representative Gerlach, he actually came up to me and he said, I like the fact that you come every year asking for the same thing because you tell us what the need is and the problems that we need to solve. You recognize that you're not always going to get what you're asking for, but you have to ask. And that came from Senator Gerlach about why these cases need to be made all the time. As Ms. Guapola commented, this year is a year where if we were silent, we would be neglecting the budget woes that the state faces are the same budget woes that face low-income folks. My representative, Representative Haldeman, said there's a job crunch, a housing crunch, a credit crunch, an energy crunch. Each of those crunches are things that impact low-income people most and people at risk of homelessness. And so why wouldn't we want to fund a program that makes us more efficient and better competitive on a federal level? And that's why we're bringing the case to you today.
Any other questions, members? With that, then, Representative Moe renews his motion to lay this over for possible inclusion into our omnibus bill.
And Chairman, I don't believe we need to vote on that.
I wasn't planning on it.
Okay.
But thank you for your testimony today.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee.
Next on our agenda will be House File 2324, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take a moment while Representative Winkler gets ready to welcome in the audience the students from Burnsville High School. They are constituents of Representative Biskins, Representative Mason, Representative Medor, and myself. And they're spending the day here tracking bills and talking to authors and sitting in our committees, and I'd like to welcome them. Thank you.
Representative Swale.
For welcoming people. Yesterday I had the wonderful opportunity to meet this week's group of outstanding Minnesota House pages, and they are sitting in this area over here. And I just want to know they're bright, and they are intelligent, and they're here because I think they are enjoying the political process. So I would like to welcome you as well.
Wonderful. Then, welcome to anybody else that we didn't already acknowledge. We are on House File 2324, and I need somebody to make a motion to move this, and the motion would be that it will be recommended to pass our committee and be referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Representative Lane will move House File 2324, and will make that motion. Representative Winkler, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, I do have the DE1 amendment, which I'm hoping Representative Lane will also be good enough to offer. Move.
Okay, Representative Lane moves that the delete all amendments to get it in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill is in response to a particular concern in the cities that I represent, but in seeking a way to address it, I've learned that it is a bill of concern to almost any suburban area with housing stock that is aging, and in particular housing stock that is typical or lends itself well to providing housing with services or group homes. So in fact, I think it's a regional issue, and if I not mistaken, it could well be a statewide issue. The issue is concentrations of group homes or housing with services along one block or within a couple of blocks in a single neighborhood. In the specific instances that came to my attention, it was 3 to 4 group homes on one block on the end of a cul-de-sac with about 3 other homes in the area. And neighbors were concerned that the concentration of those facilities was changing the residential nature of the neighborhood. In another instance, it was a half a dozen to 10 group homes, all provided by a single provider in a 3-block area. And so, knowing that this is an important issue to address very carefully, I have spent a great deal of time working with the cities, the League of Cities, Hennepin County, ARM, the Disability Law Center, care providers, and have had a series of discussions and negotiations and efforts to find a resolution. And that is, at this point, the DE1 amendment is the state of the art. Essentially, what the DE1 amendment, and I guess therefore House File 2324 would do, is to provide some basic authority to counties to consider what are the best practices for concentration of housing with services in a particular geographic area, and to use that concentration criteria as one of the factors that they consider when they enter a contract with a group home or a housing with services provider. It simply gives counties the authority to ask questions and to potentially take action in the event that a provider is not adhering to the best practices in that field. And the best practices that are I think, subject to some more careful definition, but I think the crucial point from my point of view is that the disability advocates, care providers, the trade association that work in this area all believe that there are better ways of doing or providing this kind of service than concentrating facilities in one small geographic area. And in fact, doing so is contrary to the idea of community integration, which is the whole point of housing with services or group homes, is to integrate people into the community rather than isolating them into a little pocket. So the concern is that by over-concentrating in one area, we are in fact undermining the very purpose of community integration. That is all the bill does. It simply gives authority to counties to consider this issue when they are entering contract with group home providers.
Questions from members? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. Is there anything that precludes local counties from and townships, cities from doing that currently?
Representative Stevenson, their county attorneys preclude them from doing that. The discussion I've had with, at least in Hennepin County, has been that if there is not a some kind of explicit authorization from the state, that they would be concerned that they may risk being sued for engaging in this kind of analysis and entering their contract if there isn't some kind of explicit authority from the state to do for doing so.
Representative Eastland. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, you alluded to this a little bit in your presentation, but we have no definition of best practices. I guess what is best practices? It seems to me that it really gets us out into a arena here where we're kind of referring to something that we don't really even know what it is. How do you address that,
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland? I think that will require some further definition as we hopefully move the bill through the process. Certainly, the discussion and conversations are ongoing. It would provide some discretion to the county as to how they would define it. But the point is that they are that the county is to consider what is the best outcome, best possible approach for siting group homes for the purpose of community integration. That is not really a not in my backyard kind of issue, but that they're supposed to look at what the best kind of professional practice actually is when they're making this kind of analysis.
Representative Eastland, I guess I would concur that that's something that needs quite a bit more clarity. And the other issue that it's related. But you're using another term, geographic concentration, and I guess what is that? I mean, geography can mean a block, it can mean a mile, it can mean a county, it can mean, and I guess I'm kind of, it's a pretty vague, this whole thing is a pretty vague best practices regarding geographic concentration. The geography could go well beyond the jurisdiction, the government jurisdiction you're talking about. That so I guess that's kind of I think there's a lot of vagueness here that makes me a little bit uncomfortable with kind of what we're doing. I think it makes me kind of think we don't really know what we're doing, other than just giving him permission to consider and ask him questions.
I think the most important part about this is that it, in fact, gives us the county's authority to ask some questions and to look at specific contracting entities, providers, when they are deciding whether they're going to contract with them or not, as to how they have operated and where they have sited group homes or housing and services, to be more accurate. There is, I think there may need to be some more definition, and as you well know, committee deadlines are a good time to get the concept in place sometimes and trigger some further work to define it more clearly. But that certainly is the intent, and I don't think there's anybody who's been involved in the issue who would disagree with the overall direction, so long as we can put together language that specifically will work.
Representative Eastland, thanks. One other question. You also referred in your testimony that they're getting advice from the county attorneys now that they can't do this. Can you explain why they can't do this now? I mean, is there some statutory issue that they're struggling with, or is this an opinion, or would it open them up for a lawsuit, or what is the reason why they can't do this now? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think what they're concerned about is that if, for example, there were a provider who was putting a large number of these facilities in one small area, and the county decided that that was not a good practice and that they didn't want to contract with that provider for those additional facilities and refused to do so, the provider potentially could sue the county and say, you didn't have authority or you didn't have discretion or this is arbitrary what you're doing because you're not acting under color of state law and implementing this or in going through this contracting process, and therefore the county could be sued by the provider is what I think the concern is. Frankly, I guess as somebody who has to give conservative legal advice to corporations or counties in this case, I don't think it's unreasonable for them to be concerned about that.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, It seems to me that the Federal Fair Housing Act is part of the issue here. Is there another state that has pursued a law like this? Do we have any evidence that this has helped other areas of the country that are concerned about concentrations of this kind of housing?
Representative Morgan, I don't have information about whether other states have followed this specific approach. It is something that we've been in discussions with the Disability Law Center, who have very clearly indicated their concerns about Fair Housing Act with regard to the bill that was originally, the bill in its original form. And so this is an attempt to find a way that we can meet their concerns as well.
Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, my concerns are sort of the same as Representative Eastland's. Is the concept or term best practices regarding geographic concentration, is that defined anyplace? Is there a definition of that?
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tupper, no, it isn't. And the point, I guess, is, I thought it was clear, is that the bill language may need to be further defined to get at the desired outcome here. And there simply hasn't been time to get the parties working on this specific issue. The concept kind of has developed as something that might be workable first, and that the goal is to find language that may need to change or it may not in order to get that specific outcome in statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Swale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, I'm just trying to understand the language here. It says this would be a multifamily residential use. It says 7 to 16 persons. Would that be a duplex? Would that be an apartment building? Can you explain the type of residence that the bill mentions?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swales, the typical type of residence is a single-family home in a residential neighborhood which has six or fewer people living in it. And I think it's typical in, with housing with services, the majority are services for an aging population and I think some of the disabled population as well. But it's, you know, I think maybe 80-20 for older residents. And so the typical situation is simply a residential neighborhood in a post-war suburban area that has an aging housing stock that lends itself well to providing these types of services in one facility.
Representative Moult.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, just backing up to Representative Stumper's question about best practices, I have to confess that I'm a little concerned about passing a bill out of here not knowing essentially what that is. And as you know, we have significant issues with trying to establish and locate supportive housing, emergency housing facilities around the state. And if this would, in fact, right now, you might know we're trying to establish a new year, there's significant challenges to having that in my neighborhood. And perhaps if this would provide disincentive for citing some of the projects that we're working on now, that's a significant concern. So not knowing what those best practices are, I think it's, and I think I understand what you're trying to get at here, but it inadvertently could cause us additional problems, and which concerns me and I think a couple other members. I don't know if you could address that. Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, I certainly understand your concern, and I think if you'll hear some more testimony from other people today, they certainly share your concern to a far greater degree of strength, and those are the ones that we have been talking with. And so I think doing anything that would significantly harm the ability to fight residences like this would be very disruptive and counterproductive. The point is, how can we do it in the best way possible, both from the point of view of residents, but also for the communities that they're in. And so I would expect that we'll hear some more testimony. At least my understanding is they'll say this needs some more work, but it's been a collaborative and productive process and discussion so far.
Representative Eastland. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I'm just reading through here again, and I'm looking at the definition of terms. Can you tell us a definition of what is housing with services? What kind of facilities are we talking about here that potentially cited?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I think I've touched on that. Maybe research could probably provide a fuller explanation in the specialty area.
Mr. Chairman, members, housing with services establishments are defined in statute at section 144D.01. Housing with services establishment means an establishment providing sleeping accommodations to one or more adult residents, at least 80% of which are 55 years or older, and offering or providing for a fee one or more regularly scheduled health-related services or two or more regularly scheduled supportive services. And then those definitions are also provided, one are health-related, one are supportive services.
Okay, so they could be like a halfway house or
assisted living facility.
Senior assisted living. So the range is pretty broad. Of what it could be. Then just kind of a follow up question is: does this is this going to open up a potential for litigation for different reasons, for different things in different communities? Because different units of government are going to look at this a little differently and are going to, they may ask some questions. So then it's how they respond to those questions. So can they discriminate then based on those questions? Are we kind of opening up an area here where one community, these are the rules, and another community, these are the rules, and we're kind of doing it by blanketing and giving the kind of state permission to kind of do this stuff, rather than leave the decision in the local community and leave the consequences in the local community. I just see a little bit of an issue here that with the ambiguity here, that we could be opening a door where the state is kind of giving permission and then it's kind of giving people the ability to operate, and there's not going to be any rules. Communities are going to do what they want, and the discrimination, that how they discriminate and approve different housing things, could be different as communities differ. So I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with passing this out of here, quite frankly, just without some of those things clearer in my mind.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, it's my understanding that essentially counties are the ones who are implementing state statutes regarding group homes and housing with services already, and there are, in any statute, there is some discretion for the local government as to how they would implement that. And certainly there's discretion, I think, in what counties do now, and there's a variety of in a number of areas. This seems to me a pretty low-level grant of authority to ask them to consider this issue when they're writing their contracts. All the other kinds of criteria that they use would still be in place. This isn't exempting them from the Fair Housing Act, or which obviously we couldn't do, or it's not, or exempting other sections of statute. Everything else would still apply. This is just an additional criteria that they could look at. And I don't think I could be corrected, but I don't think it's inconsistent with our approach to how we administer these types of services statewide.
Representative Swale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I'm kind of baffled by this. I've been reading through the original bill, and I like the specificity of this original bill. I like the fact that it tells about the number of people that can be in a facility, the number of seats that could exist between facilities. I don't understand how your bill, by using the term best practices, and maybe I'm echoing Representative Eastland here, but I don't understand how this is establishing a uniform standard for the state. The current bill does. The current language does. So if you could explain that to me, and also if there are some testifiers here who might be able to explain the rationale for changing the specificity of the original bill. I need to hear that. I'm really feeling the vagueness is problematic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swales, I think the specificity actually would be far more problematic because you're dealing with a wide variety of neighborhood circumstances. It's just a simple example. If you have a neighborhood with, you know, with parallel streets, you know, traditional square block street grid, a house, one house facility could be within 1,300 feet of another, but if it's on a parallel street on the same block on the other side, issues of traffic and movement of personnel and all that kind of stuff wouldn't be shared because the houses aren't right next door to each other. It almost has to be, in some ways, a case-by-case analysis by the county as to whether or not the type of siding that they're using is consistent with the notion of community integration or not. It certainly gives significant discretion to the county, but the county is sort of the natural place where that decision should be made anyway.
Representative Swales.
Well, I agree with that. I think county services are incredibly important to, you know, local control and decision making that goes on. I've had the opportunity to visit four group homes within my community, and I'm always struck by how well integrated they are into the neighborhoods. Of course, I live in a suburb, and so it would be far different than an urban area. But I guess I still am trying to understand the vagueness here. What do you mean by best practices? Is there a uniform standard of best practices that are followed for these decisions? Would every county in the state follow this prescription? Obviously, it must be somewhere, and that's what I'm not hearing.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Listening to this discussion, I understand why people are interested and concerned about what they see as vagueness. However, Representative Winkler has indicated a number of times this morning that he is prepared to work on definitions and clarifications. And in my community, I have witnessed difficulty in placement of all kinds of alternative housing, which tend to get concentrated in one or two small little areas that have and could have a detrimental effect on people who live there, who have their own homes, and suddenly these changes come. And so I think Representative Winkler has identified a legitimate issue, and I have confidence that if we can allow this process to continue, he will be able to allay some of these concerns and clarify these definitions, so I'm prepared to support his bill.
Representative Lane.
Actually, I would agree with Representative Benson by moving it into a little bit more ambiguity with the may consider regarding geographic concentration. In my first ring suburb, this kind of thing would be important. We've had some problems with not particularly this kind of housing, but other kind of housing that naturally gets concentrated in a particular area and becomes a severe detriment to the community as a whole. So now we don't do that anymore. And it's just an awareness that things should be incorporated throughout the entire community rather than focused in one area, and I think that's what this is getting at.
Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I too am in agreement with Representative Benson. I certainly trust Representative Winkler that when he says he's going to develop and work on this a little bit more and refine it, that he will do that. I guess I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if we pass this, where does it go from here?
It's passed. It's scheduled to go to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
So Representative Winkler, I happen to be on that committee, and if we do pass it here, I assume that you will work on some of this to get to there and refine it a little bit more along the lines we're talking about it.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shumper, I certainly will continue to work on it as I have been working a lot on it, and there are people in the room who will help me to make sure that I do, in addition to members of the legislature.
Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, I guess my concern is
I think that this bill should be worked out in this committee instead of sending it on to another committee. And I think that there needs to be a lot of work done on this before we send it on. Therefore, I would suggest we table this, or whatever would be appropriate. I move that we table.
Okay. Representative McFarland moves that we table this motion. This motion to table this bill. It is a non-debatable motion. Taking the vote then. All those in favor of tabling this bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not carry.
I ask for division.
Okay, division has been requested. I'll raise your hands. If you are in favor of the motion, which is to table the bill and leave it here, please raise your hand. Okay, and then those opposed, raise your hand. Six to four. On a vote of 6-4, the motion carries, and that bill is tabled.
Chair, I hope to come back soon.
We look forward to seeing you, Representative Winkler. Next on our agenda, I believe, is the Minnesota Department of Health. Are they here? Mr. Davis, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mitchell Davis. I'm the Director of the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm going to speak to the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, which is a grant program administered by the office. The Minnesota Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is a 10-year effort of the health department to address the deeply entrenched health disparities within Minnesota communities of color. And this project has been, since 2001, has provided funding and also technical assistance to 52 organizations and tribes across the state of Minnesota and 42 counties. The grantees, they work to reduce health disparities in one or more 8 priority areas. And those health priority areas include breast and cervical cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, HIV, AIDS, immunization, infant mortality, healthy youth development, and also violence and unintentional injuries. The Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative has intentionally chosen a community-based approach to address health disparities. And this approach is grounded in the philosophy, also substantiated with research, that community issues require community issues, solutions. The initiative has exclusively funded and support organizations and programs working in communities of color and also American Indian tribes to develop and implement strategies targeting to their communities. Now, none of the grantees are conventional healthcare providers, nor are they responsible to provide conventional healthcare with their grant dollars. Rather, they focus on providing education, promoting healthy lifestyles and behaviors, as well as facilitating access to health care and building community capacity. Their program strategies and approaches target to reach clients in their own environment. That's what's critical to their success as Eliminating Health Disparity Initiative grantees. Now, this community-based approach really differs from many other efforts around the country. A majority of the other efforts around the country really focus on increasing cultural competence of mainstream healthcare providers or implementing standardized practices. The areas, the grantees also work in more than one area. They were instructed to self-select the areas of their work. Many of them work anywhere from 2 to 4 different areas along to make a difference in these disparities. We reach the cultural populations of African, African-American, American Indian, Asian, Hispanic Latino, and also multiracial. And our geographic reach is about 69% in the Twin Cities area and 31% in greater Minnesota. The key elements of the initiative includes building capacity building of local grassroots organizations, developing partnerships to create greater access to healthcare, and prevention services in local communities. So the heart of is the purpose, the mission, the success, is its commitment to support health promotion activities that are driven by racial ethnic communities based in their cultural beliefs, practices, and traditions, and grounded in the assets of the community. Now available for any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Any questions, members? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question. Well, actually, two. One is I'd like to hear some of the success stories. You know what? Actually, coming out of the fact that we've invested in this eliminating health disparities. What have we been eliminating? So a little chance to brag, if that's appropriate. The other thing is, last year I believe we gave you an additional $50,000.
Yes.
And I don't know, I don't have any accounting of what that was used for, if it's been used, and I'm just wondering what you might tell us about that.
Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Pam. Here, on some of the stories.
Actually, Mr. Davis, you don't mind, I'm sorry, I'm going to be called back to the committee, but maybe you could answer the second question first, and then I'll be able to listen to the tape to hear the others.
All right.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. The appropriation of $50,000 that came to our office was certainly well appreciated and has been put to good work. The projects that are ongoing with those funds are, there's a foreign trained professionals that work in Minnesota from all across the world that have come to Minnesota. Many of them are trained physicians, very high-level medical practitioners and professionals, but they're unable to practice in those particular areas once they move to many of our states in the U.S. So one of the projects is to hold a forum of foreign-trained professionals. We're working with Dr. Wilhelmina Holder and many others who have been working around this for many years. That will be happening in May or June of this year. The second project is one that we have started to put much more attention on. It's the African health. We have been able to focus now on what's occurring with our new arrivals and also those who have been here a while in the African population. And so that forum, we were able to have a student intern from Walden University that have worked with us for the last 2 to 3 months, and we will be bringing a forum with that particular group with very focused health promotion, et cetera, activities around there. The third project is the Health Disparities Task Force. And that project was endorsed by the governor a few years ago with Department of Human Services and also Minnesota Department of Health. And there are two forums, that one's going to be March the 17th and the other one's going to be June the 2nd, which is seeking to bring the question of health disparities within health plans and providers in clinic settings. And the fourth project we've been able to enhance our data collection system with our grantees to bring a sharpen that focus and increase our system outreach so that we can collect data.
Representative Clark?
If you don't mind, would you mind giving us a written report on that? I'd come up to see how the break
comes.
Yes. Thank you. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I need to just go back to
buy that. Okay. Any other questions, members? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was kind of listed your projects here, which you know all sound like they are interesting and are going to probably yield some valuable information. What do you do with the information? We're going to have outcomes in these task forces and forums and all that sort of thing. Where does that go? Where does that information go? How does it get implemented? How does it help us better address some of the disparities that we're talking about?
Mr. Davis?
Chair, Representative, you speak of just the process of destination for the appropriation, or more broadly to the eight areas?
I think both
of them. I'll start with the Eliminate Health Disparities Initiative, those eight priority areas first. Each of those, we're required by two to reduce the disparities of infant mortality and immunizations by 50%. And then the other six was HIV/AIDS and some of the others, the statute only says to reduce. So we're focusing our efforts particularly, and I'll use the infant mortality rate in particular, to not only galvanize our efforts and also bring much more attention to it, a statewide effort, but also with our partners. Because we're only in 42 counties around the state of 87, which, of course, we don't have that tremendous, the whole state reach, but certainly with our partners, we can do more. So with the infant mortality, we'll pull some of the target rates. When we started, the baseline was 1999. When we started there, our target was 13.2. That was how many infant deaths per 1,000 of babies dying in the African-American population per 1,000. The target is 9.4. And right now, we've just reached that 9.4. The American Indian was at 13.5 in 99, and the target there is 9.5. We're now at about 10.2. So we're definitely seeing it coming down in the right direction, but we also know we have to do more. The Asian and Latino communities have met their targets. Asian was 7.1, the target is 6.3, and they're presently, from our data, 2004, they were at 5.0. The Latino was 7, was their beginning baseline. The target was 6.3 babies per 1,000 deaths, and they're now at 5.3. That's all was based on when our majority population, white population, was at 5.5. And that's what we've been using to take a look at this. The other ones are certainly coming down. They're heading in the right direction, but disparities in many cases still exist. Moving to the four projects in particular, the essence of where that data is going and what we know. We don't know, we know that there's foreign trained professionals that are in Minnesota. We have an idea in working with many other councils, including the International Health Network, that there are those who we believe that if we could continue to work more on the workforce area, certainly that this will also help bring down disparities as well.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Any other questions, members? Thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have two other members from the Department of Health, and we have 20 minutes roughly, so let's do 10 minutes each if we can, and I'm actually going to go out of order according to our agenda. If we could bring up Dr. Chandlin, and then we'll finish with the biomonitoring project.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Committee and Chair. I'm Mary Manning with the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm the Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease, both biomonitoring and the activities on cardiovascular disease are in the division that I oversee. We're very pleased to have this opportunity to speak to you this morning. First, we'll hear from, like you just requested, Dr. Chandlin.
Thank you.
Chairman Krantz and members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Dr. Stanton Chandling. I supervise the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. I was hoping, frankly, that I'd be able to start out with my message, frankly, a little bit earlier when all the students were here, and I could have left them with a good message on heart disease and stroke. I'll start that out with you. And that's basically eat less, move more, don't smoke, and watch what you drink. With that in mind, I'm going to tell you some of the things that we're finding of late as it relates to the work in the cardiovascular arena. In 2004, the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Plan was established for the state of Minnesota. Within that, this report and strategy are 5 goals, 38 objectives, and countless strategies. This was supported by the governor back in 2004. Since then, as you can imagine, we're about halfway through, so we've just come up with our mid-course review, which I'll report on some of those statistics and data in a second here. And in addition, we have our Heart Disease and Stroke 2007 Burden Report, which basically gives all of you an idea of what's going on in the state of Minnesota by county, by population, in a variety of different ways, and cutting across many different arenas to give you a sense of truly the severity of the problem in the state. To start out with, first review, and this is a little bit confusing, and so we'll clarify this. You've probably heard that cancer is the number one cause of death in the state of Minnesota, which is true. However, if you look at cardiovascular disease, namely heart disease and stroke, and you combine those two together, you are seeing the number one cause of death in the state of Minnesota. It accounts for about 28% of all deaths in this state. Some of the things that we're seeing are troubling, and even though it has come across the wires recently by information that's been provided by, for instance, the Heart Association, that we are a relatively good state as it relates to certainly heart disease. However, we have a ticking bomb that's going off, and this is why, according to the United Health Group, we are now rated number 2 in the country instead of number 1 as far as health care. And that's the issue of obesity. On my handout that I've given to you and provided to the committee as a whole, we're seeing some problems. For instance, even though some things are trending in the right direction, these things are trending in the wrong direction, namely high blood pressure. So now this is since 2002. High blood cholesterol is moving in the wrong direction. Diabetes, being overweight and obese. Since 1990, the reason why this state is now number 2, we have seen the increase in the prevalence of obesity in this state rise 142%. So, even though we are seeing good care for those of us who have to be treated for heart disease and stroke, the problem is that we have a ticking bomb that's coming up. And unless we start addressing these things, we're going to get in trouble. So what's needed, according to our mid-course review, a comprehensive approach to be implemented that addresses not only prevention, which is an important component, and it's part of the message I started out with here, but also intervention, and intervention namely to those patients that have had a particular episode, namely a stroke or a cardiac event of some sort. And what do we do with that population? We're dealing with things such as medication management, we're dealing with things such as cardiac rehabilitation, and major lifestyle changes that are frankly a little bit different than those of us who are in the realm of trying to prevent those diseases or entities from happening in the first place. In addition, some of the things that are coming out of the Centers for Disease Control that we need to really look at and look at in earnest are the signs and symptoms of heart disease and stroke. We are finding that people really are in need of strong education in this arena so that we really understand and they understand what needs to be done. Also, we need commitment of various population groups. My esteemed colleague, Mr. Davis, indicated to you that we are still seeing disparities as relates specifically to heart disease and stroke. There are some disturbing findings that have recently come out through our mid-course review. Namely, and even though it's getting better for these population groups, compared to white populations, it's not as good. For instance, 33%, as it relates to heart disease, 33% higher rates among American Indian women. 66%, again, heart disease, higher among American Indian men. As it relates to stroke, specifically, we're looking at 61% higher among African American women and 34% higher for African American men. So we have some work to do in that particular area. Going forward, some of the things that we really need to focus on are controlling high blood pressure for our citizens, looking at controlling cholesterol and cholesterol rates, increasing our awareness of signs and symptoms, having, and I've told this story before, having people be knowledgeable about when to use 911 for emergency care. I use my own mother as an illustration in this particular case. I asked her, she's 86 years old, I asked Mom, I said, do you understand when to call 911, especially if you feel as though you might be experiencing a heart attack or stroke? Her answer to me, and here I am heading the unit at the health department, she said to me specifically, am I supposed to be calling for emergency care every time I have a little ache or pain? Better to say that in case, God forbid, there's some kind of a terrorist attack, let it be for that. But that's just counter to what we should be telling our people. That's what the system is for. Use it. In addition, we need to look at improving quality of care. And what does that mean? And that gets into this whole span of services, not only for people who have not experienced an event, but also for people who have. And what does that mean? That means having care after an event, hopefully so we don't see a recurrent event happening. And then finally, I'll end by saying eliminate health disparities. One of the reasons why we're a good state is, yes, for the white population, we are doing fairly well. But nationally, our statistics do not really rate up when we're dealing with disparities, since we have our work cut out for us in that area. With that, I'll close my remarks. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Dr. Shanley. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Shanley, I'm just wondering, since last year, the legislature had appropriated, I think it was $200,000 for stroke and heart disease prevention, which did not become law. I'm just wondering, what is the Department of Health's budget now in actually implementing this prevention strategy that you've just been discussing?
Chairman, Representative, right now all of our funding comes from the Centers for Disease Control, and we operate on a budget of $400,000 a year.
Okay.
Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman. Well, we're aware that the Healthcare Prevention Commission is working on some of these issues, and we're all hoping that they will find some potential gains during cost savings and also help people avoid these healthcare catastrophes. So I'm just wondering, with the budget that you have, what are the focuses of the department's spending? What are you? Where are the emphases being placed?
Chairman Krantz, Representative, our focus is really aimed at addressing what we are funded from CDC. In other words, focusing on their priorities specifically, given the fact that that's where our funding comes from. And they have those six priorities that I mentioned before, namely addressing cholesterol, high blood pressure, emergency response, quality of care, and eliminating health disparities. Now, they are also focusing on what we call secondary prevention, namely addressing cardiac events and stroke, usually after the case. None of that, or very little of it, is focused on primary prevention. In our state plan, our state strategic plan, which outlines a variety of different activities and strategies, yes, indeed, we cover both angles, both on the primary prevention and the secondary prevention, yet limited. And our focus from a state perspective is not only to address our funding priorities through CDC, but as best we can try to address some of the strategies in our state plan, and that's done through our Heart Disease and Stroke Statewide Steering Committee.
Mr. Chairman, one last question.
Representative Benson.
Since the funding, the additional funding that the legislature provided did not materialize, does your department contemplate the administration seeking long-term funding for those projects that were contemplated last year?
From a state level, we at the Department of Health have not.
Mr. Chairman, without those additional funds, will the programs that are specific to the state of Minnesota be able to be carried out?
Dr. Chandler.
Chairman Cranston and Representative Benson, the answer to your question is that there's always a greater need to do programmatic initiatives, always, based on what I've already testified to. Is there a greater need from a state perspective in order to address these things? Frankly, that's a decision that I think a body like this needs to address, is whether or not it's based on the citizens that are dying and are being affected by this, whether or not there is a need to put more money into it in order to address the programmatic initiatives that we have.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wouldn't want to put you or persons in the Department of Health on the spot, but it seems that this would also or ought to also be a concern of the governor and his administration, since, as you indicated, this is the major health problem facing our state as it is in the rest of the country. I just want to make that comment. I would hope to see a little more action and interest in this issue from the governor's office. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Dr. Chandling, thank you for your...
Thank you very much.
Our last presentation will be by Dr. Johnson on the biomonitoring program. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jean Johnson. I'm an environmental epidemiologist in health promotion and chronic disease at the Department of Health, and I've been directing the activities under the new Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program. This is a brand new program, so we have been in essentially startup mode since we started. But I'll give you just very briefly an update. There are two handouts that unfortunately the black mark across the top didn't convey what they are. The letters got lost there. That did say the one that has starts with at the October 23rd, 2007 meeting. That is the Minnesota Department of Health update on environmental health tracking. And the other handout with the black mark across the top that starts that has arsenic at the top, that is Minnesota Department of Health update on biomonitoring. So these two activities have been very busy getting started. Just briefly, I'll mention the tracking first. Tracking, you may recall from the legislation, is defined as the ongoing collection, integration, and dissemination of data about environmental hazards, exposures, and diseases or health outcomes. What we have been doing since our first panel meeting, we were advised by the panel at that time to proceed with developing a set of core indicators that would be consistent with what the National Environmental Health Tracking Program is doing. This is a program funded by the CDC, and it funds about 16 states around the country. We are the only, however, state-funded environmental health tracking program, and so we are initially modeling our program after the same activities that these other states and that the CDC are doing. So we've been adopting some of their same procedures and methods. The core indicators that they've identified and which we are also looking at are drinking water, carbon monoxide poisoning, respiratory and cardiovascular disease, hospitalization, air quality, birth defects, and looking ahead, blood lead, vital statistics, and cancer. We'll be developing a specific set of indicator measures on each of those areas, and we will have all of that for you in a report to the legislature a year from now. So we're making progress with those. And then in the area of biomonitoring, the biomonitoring statute directs us to do a pilot program, essentially doing four pilots, one in arsenic, one in PFCs, one in mercury, and one in a fourth chemical to be designated. And just a quick update, the arsenic project, we are moving ahead. The plan there will be to measure, collect urine samples from 100 children in South Minneapolis in an area where the soil is contaminated with arsenic. That project has moved through the scientific advisory panel. It's also, we've had community meetings, so we've gotten community review and input on it. And we're now at the point where we are ready to submit that protocol to our institutional review board for their approval. The institutional review board, or IRB, is essentially an ethics review board. They look at the protection of human subjects in research, and they are really the final step before we can begin any work or any contact with human subjects. We need IRB approval to move ahead. So hopefully that's the last hurdle that we hope to pass in March, and then we'd be able to actually begin the project in April or May. The PSC project is kind of right behind that one. That project proposing to look at collecting blood samples in adults in the East Metro area in communities where there is drinking water contamination with PFCs. So we will be sampling 100 adults who are served by the Oakdale Municipal Water Supply and another 100 adults served by contaminated private wells in Lake Elmo and Cottage Grove. This project is also has been through the Science Advisory Panel, and we've had several community meetings, and you can see from the update there's been a lot of community interest in this project. So we've had a lot of activity there. And we are now just getting to the point where we're going to be making some final revisions on the protocol, and we'll probably be submitting that to the IRB in April, most likely. The Mercury project is still under discussion. We haven't made any decisions on that one. And the fourth chemical, we are now looking at what the process should be for making the selection of the chemical. And I think I'll just stop with that. If you have any questions.
Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Duss. I just want to thank you so much for all of the work that you've done in the East Metro related to the PFCs. I think the responsiveness of the Department of Health has been very, very, very professional, and the work that you've done in providing community input, telling citizens what the health risk values are of the various chemicals has been very, very helpful, and we look forward to the upcoming hearings that you're going to be having, I guess, later this month or next week, actually, in Woodbury, where I live. So thank you so much for that. There is an area of concern, though, that I think the Department of Health still needs maybe some PR, and that is the work that or the lack of information that was not provided to the miners up north related to the asbestos and causing the lung cancer that they experienced. And I hope that the Department of Health is able to kind of heal that lack of trust that was created in that incident. I think that was not helpful to the department. But, you know, there's not a perfect agency, and I do feel like you are doing steps right now to establish the public's trust in the work that you do. So thank you very much.
Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, for the fourth chemical you're needing to identify for the pilot project, I'd certainly like to nominate atrazine, and I certainly think it strongly meets the first criteria, and I'd be happy to lobby the commissioner on the specifics of that if you'd like. So
I hope you'll
forward that to the commissioner.
Chairman, thank you. So I will forward that along.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Any other questions, members? With that, I'd like to thank the testifiers once again for this information. And we do need a motion to approve the agenda from last meeting. Representative Swales, thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. No. Motion carries. Then, at this point in time, let's grab some lunch like we had over to the floor. This meeting is adjourned.